Hello, everybody, and welcome to a very special Frank and Stan chat. This is part of the Spotlight program that we organise, where we invite guests and we have a single topic to discuss. And I'm delighted to say that Roz and Peter have joined us again to talk about the headrest report. And they joined us last year, and the discussion we had and the number of views and everything was really impressive. So clearly, this is a topic that people are particularly interested in. And the timing's great because I think it was about 2 weeks ago that the 2024 version of the report was published. So, let me just go to Roz and then to Peter for them to introduce themselves, then we'll get into the report. So, Roz, can you just introduce yourself to everyone?
Yes, I'm Roz McMullen, and I was a head teacher of one sort or another, academy principal, CEO, worked as an NLE, and I set up Headrest with three colleagues in 2020, Pete, wasn't it?
October 2020.
Memory is better than mine for that. and we set up the Headrest helpline then.
Yeah, great. And Peter, obviously you were involved in that, but what was the story before that?
I basically worked largely in mainstream up until about my last 15 years when I moved into special ed, and I was a special education head teacher, special school head teacher of a complex needs school. And basically, Roz and I have known each other for some time, and basically Headrest was looking for somebody with a special school background, right. And that's basically how I came onto the Headrest scene.
Right. So just to go back to the origins of it, I mean, how did it all begin? How did the Headrest project commence?
Well, I had retired in, technically retired, although I did an awful lot of work in the system, but I had retired in August 19. Pete had already retired. Pete's older than me.
Thank you very much for that.
That's obvious.
But it became really clear to me when the pandemic hit. I mean, there were two emotions for me, really. What one was huge relief. I was no longer running schools because it was just how complex. And I have been running four secondary schools prior to retirement. And you do that thing, don't you, where you think how in each of those four schools you would have managed the situation. And, of course, it would have been different buildings, etc. So, you know, I've thought about that. But I also began to feel incredibly guilty that I'd retired because it was so obvious that head teachers were having the most god-awful time. And I thought, you know, I just felt guilty, really. And I reached out to colleagues who I knew were also fairly recently retired and said, you know, there must be something we can do to help because this is just untenable, really. And I was coaching some CEOs and some heads. And it was obvious that there were a lot of heads out there who didn't have somebody with experience, you know, to turn to. I mean, I remember one of the CEOs saying to me, God, if I hadn't had you to ring up and just sound off to, what would I have done? And I just thought, this isn't great, you know?
So it was harder, wasn't it? Because there wasn't that social networking because often they were in isolation.
Exactly that. And so I reached out to people that I knew and trusted. And I said, you know, what can we do? And Andrew Morrish got back to me and said, look, let's set up some sort of phone helpline where they can ring an experienced head. So I put a team together of Andrew, Kenny Frederick, who most people will know Kenny. She was one of my role models because she's even older.
That's a good answer. That's made me feel better.
And Peter, because I've known Peter since I first started teaching, actually. Peter was somebody who helped me learn to teach. And I knew Pete had special school headship experience. And it was very clear, Frank, right from the start, that head teachers of special schools were in a particularly difficult
place. Yes.
Really important to get that expertise on. So that was kind of how it started. And really and truthfully, what we did is we got an old mobile phone from one of my drawers. £10. Published the number on Twitter. And said, ring this, you know, and we'll manage to get back to you. But what happened was Navigate NDC, they reached out and said, how can we help?
Right.
Could you give us a free phone number? So Navigate NDC sponsored Headrest by giving us a free phone number. And that's great because people can record a message. I get an email immediately off that message, and then I farm it out to one of the four, whoever's available. And then we had an anonymous person who's quite well known in the sector who said, "I want to help as well." And they sponsored the website, and people can email the website as well. So we get requests in. I think we've always managed to get back to people the same day, usually within hours.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think for Stan and I, we occasionally get people call us up, and it's and actually, I think I don't know if Stan's placed on this, but I'm probably not trained to do this sort of work. So actually, it's very helpful to have somebody that you can pass these sorts of referrals on to, and give details of the website and the number.
I think I'm in a slightly different relationship with the heads that are likely to ring me because we
Yes.
walk them through providing advisor support. And therefore, usually a phone call to me is to say, can I get in touch with their advisor who they trust to have that conversation with?
Yeah, I suppose the benefit we have is we sit in a silo outside of any of their organizations, probably.
Yes. Now, I mean, last year, I think we were all. It was the first report I read last year. I don't know if it was the first report Headrest had produced, but I was shocked. I was not surprised, but I was shocked. All those sort of feelings that it confirmed what I thought, but actually what I thought, I didn't really want to address. But this year, I don't know whether it's the content, isn't it? But because I've got 2 years of these reports, it's hit harder. And it'd be interesting for you to sort of take us through, perhaps how things have changed in the history of the organisation and how some of the things have shifted this year, which weren't present last year. And then can we get into some of the factors, some of the what you call the stressors, in the system?
I think, if we looked at it between October 2020 and November 2021, most of our calls were revolving around the issue of COVID and the management of COVID, exacerbated by what could perhaps generously be described as muddled guidance from the DfE, which often left people at their wits' end. That was very much the first phase. We then went into a phase basically between December and April where inspections came back online. And we had colleagues who were on their knees, fearful of school inspection at a time when they still had staff absent because COVID hadn't totally gone away. And if ever there was a time for a big listen from Ofsted, that would have been it. Wouldn't they have gained a lot of points if they'd said, look, we know you've been under a lot of pressure. We'd like to come out and hear how we can support and what we can do as an inspectorate. What an opportunity missed.
See, Peter, it would have been helpful, wouldn't it? That forget the inspection. This is about evidence gathering, about for ministers, for government, about how are schools actually coping with it. Let's have an honest, open discussion about those
Actually,
issues.
what schools did well in the pandemic for future reference, because there may well be another pandemic or some similar sort of incident 15, 20 years down the line that we need to be ready for.
I
Then
mean,
on the cross.
the truth is, when we set up Headrest, all it was meant to be was the basic premise was if you haven't sat in the chair, you don't know what it's like. And I think those of us who've been head, we know that. Unless you've sat in that chair and have that weight of responsibility, you don't know what it's like. And so we wanted to give the opportunity to head teachers to talk to another head teacher who had experience about the difficulties around COVID. We didn't think this was going to be anything other than a very short-term helpline, COVID. How do I respond to mother government guidance? How do I respond to parental pressure? What do I do about staff being sick? How do I manage these bubbles? That's what we thought it was going to be. We at that time, we the thought that we'd still be doing this 3.5 years later, I mean, it's just mad.
And
That's
what
realistic.
was said is absolutely spot on, because what we then had between sort of, I don't know, April 2021 and December 2022 was that basically colleagues who were burnt out
Yeah, they were.
and they were physically on their knees. They were like almost like saturated sponges. Information was being poured on them and it was just going straight through because they just couldn't cope with any more. And we went through that phase, and
We
that
also
was a really difficult phase.
had the fact that if you had taken up headship, as many had at that time, we had had to say to her, quite rightly, I mean, God help them, say to her, I actually don't know what headship is. I don't know what my job is because all I've been doing is managing COVID. Became clear as things started to become more normal, and I don't think they did become more normal. I don't think they are normal, actually. But as things started like that, what became clear was a lot really depended on your context, not just your level of experience and when you had taken up headship, but your context. So it was clear that there were some multi-academy trusts and some local authorities that were, giving outstanding support to their heads. But there were some that were what I would just call totally bonkers. I mean, we had situations where as soon as things started opening up in any way, you've taken them back in gradually in bubbles. Multi-academy trusts who were wanting to do quality assurance visits and look at data. And you're like, what the actual, what, and the pressure that it was just, it was ridiculous.
And also, Roz, if you were a relatively inexperienced school leader, you could understand why some colleagues would go along with that.
Yes, of course. Absolutely, of course. And so some of the things that we were sort of saying was, tell them to bog off. If they want to know what to help, how to help, they can go and cover some classes and they can go and do but of course, if you're a fairly inexperienced head, if you're a newly head, you don't have the, and also they were so tired. They were burnt out. So but it was so interesting, the difference in contexts was utterly incredible. I mean, Frank, you've worked for local authorities, haven't you? And you stand local. One would like to think that local authorities and MAC central team would be like the ones we've run and actually see their role as supportive. But I have to tell you that is not the case everywhere.
Stan, what were you going to say, Stan?
What I was saying was at that particular time, I was doing some work with some newly appointed heads in Bradford, and I remember actually saying to them, this was just at the end of COVID, you haven't been a head teacher yet. You've been a manager, and the thing that you've had is the DfE managing you and telling you what you need to do, what you should do, what you shouldn't do. You are now about to go into a void where there won't be anybody telling you, and you need to prepare for that, because I could see that as a real problem for quite a number of new heads, that suddenly what they'd been doing for 2 years wasn't actually headship. It was management rather than leadership.
And is it because all of the things you've covered there really cover that fourth phase that
It
we
does.
went?
I was just going to bring you back onto it. Yeah, you're right, Peter. The only one was, though, was the one about small school leadership.
Oh, I love them. I mean, oh, I mean, I, Frank, my background was in secondary. I mean, I did the primary schools in a trust around, so I know a little bit about primary leadership, but generally I've run big secondary schools. I mean, talking to people who basically were the head, who were the bursar, finance manager, who were the estate manager, caretaker, who were opening up the schools, doing some teaching. I mean, I wouldn't know how to manage my it was just, and of course, if they didn't have a good local authority or a good multi-academy trust looking after them, these people were just completely isolated and utterly exhausted.
And, with no senior leadership colleague to prop them up, nobody else to confer with.
I think it sort of highlights, doesn't it, the sort of how thinly guarded and supported these smaller schools are. How sort of vulnerable they are. And it's
Go right back,
amazing
Frank, to
that more don't fall over. Go on, Stan.
you can go right back to Ofsted, and when they sort of came out with self-evaluation as the thing to do, and how you should evaluate the other teacher and give them hard feedback. And I was always saying, I'm in a two-teacher school. I wasn't, but I was advisor for some two teacher schools. So you're expecting a head teacher to sit down and give hard feedback to somebody and then say, am I still all right for my lift home? Because that's what life's like in a small school. Now, I've got three groups rather than just one. There's only two of us in.
So really, I mean, we got to now December 23, and I think the report goes on to identify, you know, I'm not saying culprits, but what are the factors? That's probably a better word, isn't it? Yeah. What are the factors that are adding to this stress this year, and how's that shifted in the 12 months?
Do you want to start, Ros, or shall I?
Well, I mean, if we just go back a little bit, Frank, it became sort of... HEDYES was never going to be, we were not a campaigning organisation, right? When Ofsted started going back out there again, and I think I'm right in saying that that was the autumn term of 21.
Yeah.
My view is that every inspection done during that term isn't worth the paper it's written.
Yeah.
The difference in approach and the terrible things that were going on were just awful. Now, that made us begin to write letters because we could see, I hate to have to say it, but we saw Ruth Perry coming, not in Ruth Perry, but we could see it was going to happen. So we wrote to the secretary, I think it was Nadeem Sahawi, which tells you the times. God, we've had so many. But we wrote to Amanda Spielman, we wrote him, we started writing. Now, what I have recently heard from Ofsted, well, from people leaking from Ofsted, Frank, is that the reason why Ofsted pay no attention to HEDYES and won't talk to us is that they see us as a campaigning organisation.
Yeah.
We were never a campaigning organisation. We were forced into writing because we could see what was happening. And the fact we're not listened to, you can imagine how we feel about that. Oh God, I've forgotten
that's really disturbing, isn't it, really? I mean, I am a fan of inspection. I was not a fan of the Spielman era. But actually, an organisation that isn't willing to listen or connect with a group of people who are actually managing or getting sight of probably the worst elements, the most stressful elements, the elements where people could fall over. You know, to me, that's sort of saying something about how caring and willing they are to open up to, you know, hearing some of these messages. You know, I think for me that is, you know, deeply concerning. If they were saying, well, we don't want to speak to you because we think you're trying to diss us or to, you know, make us out to be rubbish. You know, I think that really is concerning. If you're hearing that, Ros.
Well, I am hearing that, and I'm hearing that directly from people who work in Ofsted. So that is quite alarming. So I think sort of how things have gone on since then in terms of stressors, Ofsted remains a big stressor. But I do think, and it was interesting reading Sam Freeman's tweet this afternoon, I know you were reading it because I DM Sam actually. Special needs, what's happening with special needs and SEND is absolutely appalling at the moment. And that is becoming, I would say, a major things that we have had, and we didn't used to get these calls, but we're getting a lot of these calls now, are from head teachers who are heads of independent special schools.
Right.
Now, this is interesting because when you say the word independent school, we all automatically think of sort of, you know, fee-paying schools.
The Eton and the Harrows of this world.
These independent special schools are not that at all.
No.
At all. And I don't really know a huge amount about them, but what seems to be the case at the moment, it's feeling to me that the people, the head teachers who are in charge of these schools, are at the sort of, the top end of a pressure that's building through the system, and they are unloved and unprotected by anybody. And I assume, and I don't know a lot about this, but I assume that their direct line managers are actually in some kind of profit-making situation because they are independent schools, and I don't know.
Yes, some of them are. I think some of them are. Yeah.
So it seems to me as if they are in a really difficult position. So we're getting more and more stresses arising from SEND, but we're actually seeing that playing out in some very alarming ways, I think.
I think the other pressure that's happening for independent special schools, as council budgets have got tighter, I think there's a movement to get more youngsters back into local authority provision and to cut back on the independent school provision, because that will be cheaper.
Yes,
and that's also manifesting itself as a pressure on independent schools, because actually, I'm trying to put this the right way, I just wonder, and this is a question rather than a statement of fact, whether for some local authorities, they're losing sight of the quality of the provision that that youngster might be getting, or the damage of moving that provision as against the cost saving, because they are under, through no fault of their own, it's local authorities, massive budget constraints.
Yes, yes, definitely. And
I think that's adding to the difficulty in that sector.
I mean, there is no provision. I mean, that's the top and bottom of it. There just is no provision, and the amount of increasing need is just, I can't quite get my head around the need that we're seeing now coming into schools. And I had one head teacher that I coached, this wasn't from a headrest call, saying to me that there's obviously a really massive big difference between having a visit from a health visitor and taking a phone call from a health visitor. Oh yeah, I can do that. You know? So what we're seeing now post-COVID is kids coming into reception. Now, we were used to hearing stories about kids not being toilet trained when they came into school. We're getting stories now, kids can't walk. In school. So the need, the dread, I mean, it's just exponential, the burst of need, and at a time when there is less and less resource, less and less provision. And everybody in this system's under pressure. And most head teachers are by nature, and I do believe this, I absolutely believe
I know what you're going to say.
Most head teachers by nature are inclusive. Yeah. You know, that's their motivation. But the book stops here for health and safety and responsibility and whatever. I think it's just off the scale, the pressure around them at the moment.
And just, you know, you just talk to any special or mainstream teacher about the challenge of getting a CAMHS referral.
Yeah.
The challenge of accessing social services for your most complex cases.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't do it. And so schools have become the front line for some of the most complex needs. And not only are they the front line without the adequate support they need to do that job properly.
Yeah,
I think this will be the 2024 issue.
Yeah, yeah. Oh well, that, I mean, it's also the pressure that when you can't progress it, possibly through no fault of your own as a head teacher, but you're the front of house, aren't you? Contact with the parent and the carer, you know. So it's all coming through you, and some of those conversations I can imagine are tense. You know, they're personal as well, aren't they? Because obviously, as a parent or a carer, you're invested in your child's future, you know, and through no fault of the person sitting in front of you, you've not been able to secure the support that's required, you know. So that adds to that pressure. Again, going back to inexperienced head teachers having to encounter that for the first time, you know, probably much greater challenge than it was when I was a head, you know.
Yeah, I think there's also a phase thing there as well, Frank, that the move from primary to secondary will cause an explosion of this, because primary schools tend to cope with difficult children with difficult circumstances, because they're more of a community, they're smaller, they're able to do that. When these troubled children, I'll call them, get to year seven, there isn't that support. It's a different kind of support, but it's not there. I think what we'll see soon is an explosion at that early secondary of children who've got real mental health issues, who've got disadvantage issues, who've got behavioural issues.
Did you find head teachers saying to you with these conversations that I can't actually deliver what I want to deliver? That in effect, they felt as though they were constrained by either a trust or the government or whatever it may be, you know, that they wanted to do things differently, but couldn't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's all the time. I mean, the thing is, you know, I've always believed hard work isn't what causes stress. What causes stress is feeling completely powerless to solve the problems, really. Nowhere. And that is absolutely the case. And I think that the thing about the relationship with parents as well, that is another stressor in the system at the moment. And I think what that comes from, I think that comes because schools were actually the last thing standing for families and parents who were struggling. Mm. So know that the most disadvantaged communities suffered the most during COVID. That's just an obvious statement, you know, and we know that to be the case. In the old days, when you were kind of, you know, at the end of your tether, you'd go and have a good old moan at the GP, you know, or whatever sort of support of family, you know, around all these support services. Those support services don't exist. Austerity has killed all of that off. You can't see your GP now. So, but the person who is accessible. So I think head teachers are finding, a lot of heads are finding more and more of their time is having to deal with things that are outside their expertise, although they're becoming quite expert in it, outside their expertise, but really well outside their job descriptions, you know, they shouldn't have to be doing. But because we do the best for our young people, this becomes really, really difficult. And so there's that, you know, we're getting nowhere, we're powerless, we can't make things better. It's really a thing that's very much there, isn't it, Pete?
That, and I think there's also this issue of, I think I would hate to be a school leader in the present climate because you've got the complex combination of diminished autonomy alongside oppressive accountability. And that's such a horrible, toxic combination to be leading through, where actually you feel your autonomy is reduced, yet your accountability has been increased quite significantly.
And there is such a difference in terms of the understanding of that from governing bodies, multi-academy trust, local authorities. I mean, there just is a massive difference. So, you know, it was always my view, and I know you operated like this as well, Frank, that, you know, your job as CEO was to keep as much of that accountability pressure away from the head so they could do a damn good job. Unfortunately, you know, we have colleagues who don't see it that way. And we have governing bodies who don't see it that way. And so they're not protecting or looking after their head teachers at all. They're just making it, you know, a whole heap worse. And that really is just awful.
So really, is I mean, I'm not asking you to tell us telephone, you know, the number of calls you get, that sort of stuff, but in a way, the severity of the calls, the sort of issues that are being raised, they're getting more complex, they're getting probably more difficult to resolve as well.
Well, this is not a good time to be asking us. I mean, about 3 weeks ago, Pete, was it? We took probably our worst call where I had to keep talking. I had to keep somebody on the phone. And I think you have all been involved, all the headrest team with that colleague in one way or another. And we've all lost sleep over it.
I think the frightening thing is that that's not the only such call. We can probably all of us go back over the last year in a bit, and we've had calls that may not have been quite as severe as that, but we're going that way.
Having said that, you know, but we have obviously a private way of communicating with each other to sort of we provide supervision for each other, basically. And you know, we had a couple of calls where we say, you know, it was such a relief to take this call because it was quite normal.
That's interesting because, in a way, it's become more like, I mean, some of the calls then are not, are more about, as you say, having somebody to chat to about particular issues. They're not sort of at the tipping point of the individual falling over.
And interesting, one of the things we put as a stressor was this issue of, for new t head teachers, it was a sense of imposter syndrome. For more experienced head teachers, it was that abyss of self-doubt. But actually, what quite often with those conversations, somebody would s express what their concerns were. We'd then requalify it and sort of say, look, have you looked at the positives? And by the end of the call, the calibration had gone back the other way to actually, maybe I'm not doing as badly as I thought I was doing. And some of our calls are that sort of nature.
They are. I mean, I in the past 2 weeks, I've taken calls which have been about keeping somebody alive, and calls which are actually what's really bothering you is you're frightened of retirement. Have you thought about planning for a happy one?
I suppose for some people, they don't know. what the threshold is for calling either. You know, for what might be, somebody may well have sort of just tried to deal with it and got to a very bad place, when in fact an earlier call might have resolved an issue for them. Stan, you were going to say something there, I think.
I was just going to say part of the issue must be that you know, we've got a fractured education system at the moment. I'm thinking back to when I worked in Lancashire and every new head teacher had a mentor appointed. There was no money changed hands. Every head who volunteered to be a mentor did it in their own time, and everybody had a relationship with another head teacher, an experienced head teacher, who could often deal with that first level question. But well, I don't want to discredit the National College, but them introducing a paid version killed it for us in Lancashire.
Right.
Suddenly there was something you get paid to do, so it wasn't easy to get volunteers in that case, and it just faded. And now I think with, you know, trust not really having enough head teachers to be able to offer everybody a mentor, particularly small trusts, and whether the relationship across trusts and across trusts and local authorities is at a strong enough level yet that people can trust each other across those boundaries.
I mean, I think that you make a very good point there. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I've done a lot of is network our callers into people I know in the country that they can talk to, because even some people who are in MAT, I took a call recently from somebody who's on a MAT, but actually that MAT's very geographically dispersed.
Mm.
And so they're not getting the benefit of a local network. And actually the head was very, very isolated. Now, I just happen to know some heads in that part of the country, so I basically organised for this head to be picked up by them and put, because being able to talk to somebody is so fundamental to our mental health, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's so fundamental. And one of the things that have been really destroyed in many ways, I think by austerity, I think by, in some ways, the demise of local authorities and the way that some maths are so much better and so much worse than others, and also, of course, primarily by COVID, is that these networks have gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some people have natural networking skills and some people don't. You're overwhelmed. You're not very good at networking. But actually, it's that can often solve an awful lot of your problems.
And I think, you know, if we looked at some of the stresses, I think one of the interesting ones was the massive difference between those local authorities and MATs who were good at supporting their colleagues, those who were less good at supporting their colleagues' well-being, and a small number who, if I'm honest, were almost malevolent in approach to supporting colleagues who needed support.
Yes.
Yeah.
And those are quite harrowing when you're getting that call from somebody who is feeling maybe things aren't going right, but they're being hung out to dry, and nobody's really bothered about their well-being.
Mm.
Those are desperate calls to take.
Yeah.
I had a head teacher in tears after an unfavourable Ofsted. Not because of the unfavourable Ofsted, that was making him angry. But what made him cry was the fact that I rang up to see that he was okay.
Yeah. And probably, quite conceivably, you were the only person who did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just to say, you know, I know what the result of your Ofsted is. I know you're unhappy with it. But away from that, how are you now? How are you feeling? How are you operating? Mm-hmm. And there's been a couple like that. And it's not just dropping into a category either. It's an outcome that people don't feel it was fair.
Yeah.
And that really hurts to somebody who's leading, you all know, as leading an organisation, if somebody picks a hole in it,
it
feels like a wound. And I felt that even the drop from outstanding to good, even where it's been expected, still a feeling of this is unfair. You're not judging us fairly.
And it's interesting that one of the things that's coming up quite frequently in calls, or more frequently than we've ever had before, is the two requires improvements cliff edge.
Oh, yeah.
And that's becoming a major concern now with head teachers after the second RI.
Yeah.
Feeling that they're the ones who are made the scapegoat. It passes down the line from regional director to the mat to the head teacher's desk. And somebody's got to be the scapegoat somewhere once the two RIs are met.
Yeah.
And quite often it feels like it lands on that head teacher's desk, regardless of whether they deserve it or not, if that makes sense.
It's becoming completely clear, I think, to everybody in the system now, apart from Ofsted themselves, that it's got to stop. It's just not tenable. We can't run an education system like this, because it's just not. Well, they've become a very malevolent force. They are now preventing school improvement. They are preventing head teacher retention. They're preventing head teacher recruitment. They're creating a really, really bad. Now, I haven't, Pete, looked at. I mean, it is astounding that they haven't approached us anyway. But I haven't looked at the big list and questions. But I know you have, and I know that you think that it's just a load of let me ask you a question because I want you to give me this answer.
I'm trying to put it the right way. It's rather like asking, do you want your apple pie with ice cream or your apple pie with custard, but not actually asking you whether you want
Whether you
apple
want the
pie
apple pie, that's a very good way of describing
or
it. And those of us been involved in these previously know how these sorts of questionnaires are developed, you know. So, and also, having been implementing new frameworks or planning to implement new frameworks, I remember one survey where the responses to a particular question were very negative, but the response was, well, we'll focus in on the parents and the carers group in response to that because they're very positive about it. You know, actually, so what happened was we ignored, and I say we because I was part of that regime, we ignored the profession. We went to the group that supported the proposal. And actually I can see how the questions, you know, the way they're going to come through, that they're not particularly challenging, are they? As you say, Peter. So even if there was one that wasn't going to give them the response they wanted, they could find a way of actually emphasizing an element or a response which is favorable to what they want.
I'll admit, being cynical, I tend to look at it rather than the big listen as the big steer.
Well, what we do will respond, but we will publish our response so that people can see how headdress responds. Because our evidence base is vast. It's vast.
You know, we've got hundreds of hours of conversation with teachers, with school leaders.
The school leaders, the heads.
Well, I think we've covered quite a lot there. I'm really grateful for your time, and let's hope, well, if there is another report in 2025, let's hope it's a much more positive report. Indications are it might not be. It's going to take a while to get to a more positive picture, but let's hope. And again, if anybody who's watching this knows of a colleague, a family member, whatever, who feels they may, you know, may be under a lot of stress related to the work that they do in schools, you know, then if they're a school leader or whatever, reach out to Headrest, and you know, you'll get this sort of response, which I mean, yeah, well done. Well
Thank
done. Well done
you.
to everybody.
It's lovely to see you both.
And you. Okay. Well, until next time, folks, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you soon. Bye bye.